The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival is sponsored in part by Soyombo Mongolian Vodka, crafted in small batches at the original distillery site of the last emperor's palace in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Online at mongolianvodkas.com/soyombo. The Daily Buzz on KCPW is sponsored in part by Sabra Hummus. Inspired by flavors from around the globe, Sabra's dips are handmade from fresh ingredients and spices. Sabra's mission is to bring healthy Middle Eastern cuisine to people's everyday diets. Online at sabra.com.
It's the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. It's Wednesday, January 22nd, kicking off another edition from Sundance 2014. Our guests on today's show will include the filmmakers behind Whiplash, Ivory Tower, Sleepwalker, filmmaker Sam Green, who's at Sundance with a new interactive documentary, as well as Matt Bolish, who curates interactive programming and immersive media programming for the Film Society of Lincoln Center. We'll have more from Sundance coming up right after the news from BBC. And we're heading into day 7 here at the Sundance Film Festival. We've kind of passed the midpoint now. We're at Wednesday, day 7 here with my colleague and co-host of the Hot Topics segment, Brian Brooks from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. This is Eugene Hernandez. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Eugene. It's good to be back.
So we're just, you know, wrapping up this kind of, we did our big roundup of Hot Topics on Tuesday's edition. And for this Wednesday show, as we kind of get ready to head back to New York, just kind of reflecting on some of what's happened this week. Mm-hmm. And we'll do another segment later in the week as we wrap up the show for the week. But coming up in a minute on today's show after Hot Topics, we'll have a number of filmmakers, the folks behind Ivory Tower, Sleepwalker. Sam Green will be here to talk about his new interactive documentary, as will our colleague Matt Bolish, I should say, from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. He programs the Immersive Media and Convergence program at Lincoln Center. But before we get into that, Brian, sort of, you know, I was thinking about the business side of this year's festival. There hasn't been sort of an onslaught of deals. And, you know, maybe by the time folks tune in, you know, here today or later in the week, maybe more deals will emerge. But it certainly wasn't that avalanche of first weekend sales.
Yeah, no. I mean, it certainly started off with some good momentum with Whiplash and Sony Classics picking it up and reportedly for a decent seven-figure deal. But there's been some, and I've seen other years where it's been lighter. But of course, last year and the year before, there was quite that onslaught. Mm-hmm. But there have been some decent ones. A24, which is a distribution company out of New York that has some people that, you know, we know who are veterans of that world, but they have a new company.
Company that released Spring Breakers.
Spring Breakers, last year. Yes. And they did such a great job.
They've been busy here?
Yeah, well, they've picked up two. They got Lynn Shelton's Laggies.
All right.
And then they also got Obvious Child.
Okay.
So they picked that up. And then the other day, Fox Searchlight picked up Eye Origins,
okay.
So they'll be getting that out. And then
that's the new film by Mike Cahill. And he had a film here two or three years ago, Another Earth. Mm-hmm. And they've worked with him
before.
So they're back in business with Mike Cahill.
Actually, it was interesting, too, because I was reading Deadline.com, and they pointed out that James Franco's Kink, which played here last year, I believe, actually just got picked up. So even if films don't get picked up right at the festival, I mean, deals still happen. And the thing that's interesting about Sundance is, you know, obviously you like to say first and foremost, it is about the art, and it is, but it is also, there is a commerce component to it, and it is very important. And I know that the festival likes to play that down a bit, but I know that, you know, it is important to them because obviously we want to get these films out there and to have it be successful.
It's a launching pad for many films. I mean, I know that we at the Film Society and our colleagues at other organizations, certainly other journalists, Sundance really starts the calendar year starts off the year. And there are distributors out there looking for films to release later in the year, this fall and into next year. Yeah. So these are films we're going to be hearing about.
Yeah, and sometimes there's a bit of a strategy, I think, people might hold back, but then they'll pick stuff up later, and then and maybe the prices aren't as inflated. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, you'll certainly be keeping an eye on that. You're heading to the Berlin Film Festival in a couple weeks.
I'm excited.
After this, as are a number of films and filmmakers from this year's festival. As we round up this this Wednesday edition of Hot Topics on the seventh edition of the Daily Buzz from the Sundance Film Festival, so this is Eugene Hernandez and my colleague Brian Brooks. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez here at the Chase Lounge, Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main Street. One of the immediate hits of this year's festival, I hope you don't mind me saying that, saying that to the filmmaker sitting across from me, I'll say his name in just a moment, is a film that took the festival by storm on opening night. It's called Whiplash. The filmmaker is Damien Chazelle, and he's sitting here on the Daily Buzz. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it must be, in some ways, exhilarating, aggravating, nerve-inducing to be the playing on the opening night.
Yes.
At the same
sure.
time, to have that first screening done and for it to go so well must be this huge sense of just relief. Now you can just enjoy, right? It's out there.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was probably the most stressed out person at the festival on kind of Wednesday leading up to Thursday, but then I actually got to breathe in a way that filmmakers premiering later don't. So I guess that's the kind of pro and con of just going right away. At least you get it over with.
You sold the film, you screened it, you got great reviews, all within a few hours.
Yeah, so now it's like my main goal now is to try to get into other screens, because I feel it's like that embarrassing thing now where I've barely seen anything. But I'm here for a few more days, so I'm gonna try to pack them with movies if I can.
It was a great moment because the festival is so immediate now. You know, the responses are so immediate.
It's crazy.
So the film played on opening night, and within minutes you can go on Twitter and everybody's already telling you whether the film is good or bad. In your case, the responses on social media were exceptional. And within, again, a few hours, the film was sold.
Right.
And it was just such a great response. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us about the movie. Folks who are listening here to the Daily Buzz may not have had a chance to see it yet.
Of course. It's a movie about a jazz drummer who's a student in a very cutthroat music conservatory, kind of modeled on Juilliard. He has these sort of highfalutin dreams of being one of the great musicians of all time, but is not exactly sure how to go about achieving that. And he comes into contact with a very larger-than-life conductor/teacher at the school, and quickly learns that this guy's teaching methods are not exactly... not exactly to everyone's taste, I'll say.
Out of the ordinary.
And, a little bit. And so it was kind of, it's a mano-a-mano between those two guys. But really what I wanted to do is just make a movie about the sort of hardship, pain, anxiety, terror that goes into trying to be a great musician. There are a lot of movies about the joys of music, which I love as well. But this one I really wanted to focus on, for lack of a better word, the pain behind it.
Why was that world interesting to you? Why did you want to explore that world and explore that pain?
I sort of had a one foot in that world a little bit when I was younger. I was I'm a drummer myself, and I was in a very competitive jazz ensemble in high school, and almost went into music school. A lot of my friends went into music school and are still musicians, so we all kind of play together, and we all have these stories. I had a conductor myself in high school who was kind of like this, and we all have these stories of people who pushed us in this way, and it's always this kind of dilemma that we disagree about of whether it was worth it or not.
Yeah. What about the links between... I'm sure others have drawn this, the links between the world of music, the world of creating music, and that of film and the world of creating film.
I always wanted to do movies, and music in a weird way was kind of a phase for me, but it was such an emotional phase, it was such like a formative phase that it sort of informs a lot of what I do, I think. It was interesting being on set, kind of having this sort of dynamic where... certainly like as a director, I believe in a very, I'd say friendly set, but in many ways, one of the main characters in this movie is a director in his own way. I mean, he's leading a band, he's deciding how to kind of manipulate these performers to do what he wants. And to him, it's just about pushing people beyond the breaking point. Mm-hmm. Certainly some directors subscribe to that as well. So, the parallels were kind of fun to play around with without thinking too much about them.
Right. One of the great things about Sundance Film Festival is its opportunity to introduce press, industry, audiences to new actors and, in this case, new filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your background.
I grew up in New Jersey, though a lot of my family's from France, and so I kind of went back and forth between France and Jersey. Mm-hmm. And the jazz program I mentioned was in Jersey, of sort of a so we would kind of play a lot of the New York sort of venues and festivals. And then I kind of, you know, I, as I said, I always wanted to do movies, so I sort of stopped drumming for a while. I came to L.A. About 6 years ago now, probably, and I've just been sort of writing things since then. I made a movie out of college about jazz musicians as well, much more in the joys of music kind of terrain.
Yeah.
But this was a really kind of personal story for me that just dealt with memories of my own that I just kind of wrote quickly, put in a drawer for a few years, and then pulled out and made.
Mm-hmm. You cast Miles Teller in a key role, and he's certainly been gaining a lot of attention for a variety of roles of late. Tell me about why him, how that all came about.
Yeah. I've loved him since I first wandered into a screen in a rabbit hole back in like 2011, and it was actually around the time that I was first starting to write Whiplash. Mm-hmm. So it kind of was those nice, one of those nice happenstance moments, but I had no idea who this guy was. I loved him, and so when it came time to cast in the movie, you know, I found out he also drummed. It all just kind of made sense, so we were just lucky to get him.
Our guest on the show is Damien Chazelle, and he made a movie that's playing here at Sundance called Whiplash. What are you working on next?
I'm not entirely sure. I've got a project that I was working on before Whiplash, and I'm hoping to sort of resurrect now and dive back into and shoot soon, hopefully. But
I imagine you haven't had too much time to think about it.
It was like making the movie all the way up until basically the premiere. You know, it was one of those really kind of what they used to call dripping prints. You know, it's not a print. And
dripping digital file.
Yeah, the dripping digital file. Lots of ones and zeros just kind of falling. And then, yeah, since then, it's been kind of a whirlwind. So I'm actually looking forward to returning to normalcy for a bit and kind of wrapping my mind around what's next.
Well, again, the film is called Whiplash, premiering here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Damien's film, as I mentioned, was picked up by Sony Pictures Classics. Yep. Will be released later this year.
Yep.
We'll look for it. Congratulations, Damien.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back.
Thanks for having me.
You got it. Continuing on this edition of The Daily Buzz here on KCPW, seated across the table from Mr. Andrew Rossi, welcome.
Thank you, Eugene.
Director of a new film called Ivory Tower. You're certainly no stranger to this festival.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. We were here in 2011 with Page One inside the New York Times,
and
we enjoyed talking to you then.
Glad to have you back on the show.
Thanks.
For those folks who are listening, and we're on KCPW here in Salt Lake, but also available to folks around the country, give us a little thumbnail description of the film and tell us a little bit more about it.
Absolutely. Ivory Tower is a movie about college and whether it's still worth the cost, what sort of alternatives exist for it, and I think most importantly, trying to explain how there is a cost disease that exists in higher education that has resulted in an increase in tuition rates since 1978 over 1,000%, and now a cumulative student debt that is over $1 trillion. So people are really starting to say, what is college all about, to try and go inside the black box of college. Mm-hmm. It's this mythical ideal that we have, and try and understand more about it.
Certainly, it's a conversation that ignites debate, especially when you get those colleges involved. They're going to want to advocate to their, you know, future student bodies that the college is worth it, worth the price of admission, worth the student debt. But we all have friends who went to college and who mm-hmm. have come out of college with this massive student debt, and sort of how do you recover from that? It can take decades.
Absolutely. I mean, we in fact have one student in the film who says that her private student loans will follow her to her death. I mean, and then literally be transferred onto her children if she has any. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a debate that is not just black and white, but gray. There are many sort of things to consider. And we do in the film look at the possibility for character formation, for self-discovery, for transformation, all these things that we really want out of college. But unfortunately, once you exceed about $50,000 in debt when you graduate, you get to a point, as Anthony Carnevale, who's in the film, says, where you're going to make life decisions about career, about family formation, based on this debt. And that's not what we want our society to evolve, sort of indentured servants.
The university experience is supposed to give us options and position us for the future. In some ways, it's actually limiting our options, limiting our choices, forcing students into really tough situations.
It's true. I mean, and Peter Thiel says this in the film, we used to think that people who didn't go to college were the victims, and now the people who do go are actually potentially victims.
Our guest on The Daily Buzz is Andrew Rossi. He made a new film called Ivory Tower. Tell me about why this subject intrigued you and when and how you started exploring it.
Well, after I made page one about the newspaper industry and specifically the Times, I felt that I wanted to approach another sort of sector and do a story that includes disruption or transformation. Mm-hmm. And everyone has always said that education, along with government, is the next sort of sphere that's going to be revolutionized by technology. Mm-hmm. And so when I started to research this in 2012, it was just around the time that the Stanford professors who started massive open right. online courses mm-hmm. were starting to say, look, we can teach people online. So just this idea of capturing an institution mm-hmm. like higher ed in a moment of disruption seemed very attractive.
It's amazing to think about these disruptions. You, in the New York Times documentary, you mentioned you obviously look very closely at disruption and what they're undergoing and also what they're reporting in the business section at the Times, the media desk. We're at a film festival where the experience of seeing movies is changing and has changed. The way audiences engage with film, as a filmmaker, you are well aware of this, is different. It's not the same as just walking into a theater. So disruption is so prevalent in so many sectors of our lives, in so many industries. As you're immersing yourself in a world that is being disrupted, tell me about sort of the, in this case, some of the suppositions you made, some of the predeterminations you made going in, and maybe how they were changed as you came out.
Absolutely. Well, for me, school, even in the sort of high school, elementary part of my life, and college provided an incredibly nurturing environment, sometimes even more so than home or church, just an environment that I felt was incredibly important. Mm-hmm. So when I heard people like Peter Thiel actually offering money to people to drop out of schools yeah. and just this really negative approach to higher ed, I thought, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But then I found through all of our research and through all the people we talked to that, in fact, there is a lot of validity to this notion that higher ed has to change. And it's interesting in your point about disruption in the film world, too. CNN Films is producing this film,
yeah.
and we see how, even with the movie Blackfish,
yeah.
the amount of audience that they were able to get
huge
on television
audience.
is amplifying the message in a regular theatrical. So even documentaries is being disrupted.
It changes the game for a documentary that seeks to raise attention or awareness of an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of college, did you go to film school? Tell me about your college experience.
So I actually did not go to film school. I went to law school, and I practiced as a lawyer for a couple of years, and then made a career shift. I think I was lucky to take about 10 to 12 years until I have gotten to this point now. And I think that, you know, that's a message of the film, too, is that duocracy, which is one of the inspirations of UnCollege, this movement that says you can hack your education. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get permission to do something. You don't mm-hmm. have to be certified in the most traditional way.
I can only imagine what your career as a filmmaker would be like had you gone to film school and the pressures you might have been under. It took you some years, as you mentioned, to find your voice as a filmmaker, and now you've settled into that voice and are making some really provocative, interesting films. But I can't imagine what pressures you might have faced had you come out of film school with a bunch of debt and the choices you would have had to make.
Absolutely.
I don't think we'd be here right now.
I think you're right, because I had to take some time to, you know, work sort of other jobs in addition to being a filmmaker, which I hoped were, you know, always related to film. But yeah, you have to really take risk. And if you're saddled with so much debt, you can't.
The film is called Ivory Tower, and I want to make sure to mention that it's playing throughout the week here at the Sundance Film Festival. Number of opportunities for folks to see it. If people want more information on the film, where can they go?
They can go to, I believe, the CNN Films website, mm-hmm. And also we have a Facebook page for Ivory Tower Film.
The director of Ivory Tower is Andrew Rossi. He was here a couple years ago at the festival with Page One inside the New York Times. Glad to have him back at Sundance. Glad to have him back on the Daily Buzz.
So happy to be with you, Gene. It's always great to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Andrew Rossi on the Daily Buzz. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Back on the Daily Buzz here at the Sundance Film Festival 2014. Our guests are Mona Fastvold and Brady Corbet. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talking about The Sleepwalker, thank you for spending time with us here. Busy day. Brady, you're certainly no stranger to this festival. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Mona, what do you think?
Oh, it's so exciting to be here.
Is this your first trip actually to Park City?
Or yes, it's my first time here. And yeah, it's been really, really great. Overwhelming. But
overwhelming in what ways?
You know, it's the first time we really talk about the movie.
Do you get nervous showing it, talking about it, or do you sort of feel this, you know, sort of zen? Is it a release or is
it's a release. It really is. Yeah, it is. I get nervous showing it, right. Which is, you know, we'll do for the first time today. But yeah. Talking about it, it's been nice, exciting.
What kind of tips has Brady given you to sort of get you through the experience? He's done this before. Oh, he doesn't seem like he gets nervous about these things, but I don't know. Maybe
I've only
do.
Given her tips on how to manipulate the press.
Yeah. I'm an expert now.
We have, the thing is that it's, for some reason, I continue to be compelled to make really challenging mm-hmm. and radical movies and frequently bring them here. It's a tricky thing when you're trying to make something that's more for, you know, for the future history of the medium in a way, as opposed to something which is going to have this knee-jerk response of, oh my God, it's fucking great. We're so excited because it's not warm and cozy, this mm-hmm. film. It's mm-hmm. it's really austere mm-hmm. And bold and the filmmaking, the cinematography, the mise-en-scène. Etc.
It's beautifully composed.
Yeah,
It's
something quite immaculate. But it's just, it's always exciting and painful to present something that you know mm-hmm. some people are going to love and some people are not going to like at all or find completely confounding in some way.
And folks' opinions might evolve or change as they spend more time with the film.
Absolutely.
And that's happened a lot with not just films that you've been involved with. I think about Simon Killer in particular.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
But I think in this film, not only are the compositions so great, you're creating a really distinctive mood. But the story, as Brady is alluding to, is challenging, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about this character at the center of the film and where she came from.
Well, you know, I think every character kind of starts originating from the writers in a way,
yeah.
But then of course it takes on a completely different life as you know, mm-hmm. as you start collaborating with the actor and then with of course with the costume design with everything that kind of adds to it. But I was really excited to explore the relationship between sisters, and from a big gang of girls myself.
You are.
Huge family of women, and we it's such an interesting relationship. It's kind of balances between aggression and love mm-hmm. and jealousy and, mm-hmm. and care and.
Well, it was interesting for me because I'm an only child. I have a single mother, mm-hmm. but I just come off of 2 years of working on Simon Killer. And so, which is obviously just like such a male-dominated piece yeah. with important female characters, but you know, it's like it's a tough film filled with machismo in a way. Mm-hmm. And so, it was nice for me to immediately come off of that experience and collaborate on a film which is profoundly feminine. It doesn't mean that the film is any less bold or that the editing is any less muscular,
right.
you know, but there is a feminine attention and detail and,
right.
and grace that I was really needing a dose of after my experience on Simon.
Tell me about the writing process. Tell me about the collaboration. You two wrote this together.
Yeah.
Tell me about that collaboration and the process of working through and kind of developing it. How much time did you spend? Tell me about the.
Well, I had the story for a couple of years trying to figure out how to tell it, and I didn't quite know how to tell it until Brady and I started writing together. Mm-hmm. That's sort of when we cracked a code. But we work very closely together. We sit in the same room and we write together and you know, kind of play around with the characters and say the text over and over and over again, and really, you know, imagine all the images together. The script is very detailed in how we're gonna shoot it, how we're actually gonna you know, the visual style.
It's sort of half pre-shot listed in a way.
Oh yeah,
because
yeah.
it's sort of like wide on this, new angle on this, medium on this. Mm. It usually states what's playing in a sequence shot, what has more, what has traditional coverage, etc.
So the visuals are growing out of the writing process in a very specific way.
Yeah, the architecture of the thing is kind of already. In place. You know, but the thing is, it was easy, especially with this film, it was easier to do that because we were writing it for this location. So we did have a pretty good idea of what that end result would actually be, as opposed to the film that we're working on now, which is a film we wrote in the same way, but we don't know where we're shooting it.
Yeah.
So that is something where we're going to have to roll with the punches a little bit more, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Does that make the writing process harder or freer or
Just different, yeah.
It's nice to find somebody that wants to work that way,
right.
Because most people don't, and that's the only way that I could ever write a script. A script is a manual. It's not a work of art in and of itself.
Right.
It's something. It's not even that admirable in a way. It's kind of it's functional.
It seems like you're saying it's more of just a template.
It is. It's just it's
some writers don't say that is why I offer you know,
yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think that obviously there's exceptions to that rule, but most of the films that I'm interested in, they are sorry, it's a little distracting out there. I don't remember what I was saying.
That being said, that, you know, it is a template. We really we stay very tight to the script in terms of the dialogue and the text. You know, there's no improvisation
in
the film. It's we really find the language and the rhythm and the tone, and then we stick really closely to that.
That cadence, because there's a lot of call and response in the film. We wanted a looseness in the performances to counterbalance the kind of rigidness of the compositions.
Right. Last question: the film you're writing now. What can you tell us a little bit about it and what stage you're at?
The film that we have two projects. We have Mona's next film, which we've already written, but we're in doing very early drafts of that. And then, but before that, we're doing a film called The Childhood of a Leader, which is a film that I'm directing, but we're working in the same way that we did on this, which is very, very closely. And it's a film that stars Juliette Binoche, Tim Roth, and Robert Pattinson. And it's quite a radical film about the birth of a leader in the late 19-teens.
Mm-hmm. And you're based in Paris right now for that project.
We're based in Paris for a while. We're trying to figure out where the majority of our shoot's going to take place. We're at least doing 10 days of shooting in France, a day in Versailles. Some ambitious stuff.
Congratulations, Mona Fassival, Brady Corbet. Welcome back to Sundance.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Sundance.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The film is The Sleepwalker, playing here at Sundance. And catch it this week. Continuing on The Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez on KCPW, streaming at kcpw.org and at filmlink.com, as well as iTunes. Sitting across the table here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main Street, sitting across the table from Sam Green. Welcome, Sam.
Very glad to be here, Eugene.
Glad to have you here. Sam made a movie, but it's more of an experience. I don't want to just call it a movie because it's more than a movie.
Yeah.
It's called The Measure of All Things, and if you look in the catalog, it has in red with an exclamation point live, because this is not just a documentary, and you often don't just make documentaries, although you do that.
Yeah.
You weave in a live component. This is billed as a live documentary.
Yeah.
So for audiences listening in, either here locally or around the country, who weren't able to be in Park City to experience it live, it only has had two shows.
Yeah.
Tell us what it means to make a live documentary. What is a live documentary?
So a live documentary, it sounds sort of weird, but it's all the elements of a movie, but it happens live.
Yeah,
so I narrate it in person. I'm up on the stage, and I cue all the images that are on the screen like a movie, and then a band does a live soundtrack. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's a great chamber group called Y Music. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like a movie. You sit there in the audience, but it all happens right in front of your eyes.
I guess my follow-up question is simple. Why?
That's the great question. And I have a couple answers to that. Yeah. One is I just really love this form. I kind of happened upon it accidentally a few years ago, and I've made several live documentaries. But I really like it for a lot of different reasons. One, though, is that for a filmmaker these days, you kind of have to accept that people are watching your stuff on a laptop while they're checking Facebook. Right. I mean, I do that sometimes. Yeah. And I really love the magic of cinema, that feeling when you turn your phone off and go into a theater and you're with a bunch of strangers and you've paid some money and you really give yourself over to the experience. I love that. And so, in a way, this live format is a way to just keep that going. You have to see it live. You have to come watch it that way.
So. It's a very clever way to force your audience to leave everything behind. They're in your hands, literally.
Yeah.
Because you're leading them through the experience. In what ways, I was fortunate enough to be able to see the piece you did in New York recently with Yola Tengo, and the title is escaping me, sorry.
Yeah, The Love Song of R. Buckminster Fuller.
Terrific. And again, it forces you to completely shed anything else you've got going on and places you in the hands of the director, in this case you and the band on stage, in that case and again on this case. I'm curious to know how the experience of watching this film changes from night to night. There clearly must be little aspects of it that are different. To what extent is that built into the process?
Oh, well, that's one of the things that really fascinates me. I think, you know, I've made a lot of normal movies.
Yeah.
And when you make normal movies, you, as long as there's a screen and a good set of speakers, it's fine. As a filmmaker, I wasn't super in tune with or sensitive to the viewer's experience. Mm-hmm. So all screenings are sort of the same. Some are better than others. But with this, with these live things, and I think all performers know this, but this was new to me, every night is completely different, and it's based on intangible things like the time of the screening, the size of the room, mm-hmm. the number of people there. If it's packed, there's an energy in the room that's not there if it's half full, and mm-hmm. just little things like that. So every show is different. We mess up in different ways every time. And one of the things I like about this form, too, is I change it each time in small ways, or sometimes in big ways. So mm-hmm. with the Buckminster Fuller piece that you mentioned, I do with Yola Tengo, and we tour all over, and every city we do it in, I add something about that city. So mm-hmm. we did it in Detroit or Seattle, you know, mm-hmm. so that's great. It's a way to sort of personalize the piece, which yeah. I like.
Oh, that's very cool. You mentioned making normal films, quote-unquote. You had a film here a few years ago now, The Weather Underground.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about your background.
I got into film through a sort of weird door. I went to journalism school. I was going to be a newspaper reporter. And on a whim, a friend of mine said, want to take a video class? I hear it's really easy.
Where was this?
At UC Berkeley.
Okay.
And it was a documentary class taught by a filmmaker, Marlon Riggs.
Wow, Marlon Riggs.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Who I was vaguely aware of, but the class just really sort of turned me around. He made a huge impression on me, and his work made a huge impression on me, and that really changed my life. I was sort of smitten with documentary and also experimental documentary. His mm-hmm. work was super smart and journalistically sound, but also very poetic and moving and deep. That combination really got me.
For folks who may not know of the work and impact of Marlon Riggs,
yeah.
appropriate for you to maybe weigh in and tell us a bit about who he is and then how you imagine, now that you've had time to think about it probably, he has influenced your own work.
Well, Marlon Riggs was a documentary filmmaker who was active in the 80s and early 90s, and he made a film, his sort of biggest film was called Tongues Untied. He was black and gay, and it was came out in, I think, 91, and it was on PBS, and it was a film about the black gay experience on public television in 1991, which was radical and yeah. caused a huge stir. Jesse Helms got very mad about it.
He sure did.
That, you know, that would be a brave thing to do now, to put out a film like that, a very personal film. Mm-hmm. But then was totally radical. And mm-hmm. the thing that really moved me about him and made a huge impression was what I mentioned, that he was smart as hell. You know, he'd been to Harvard and was, like, extremely articulate, but also a real artist, and he combined two things in documentary which are rare, but I really am a fan of, which is a kind of lyricism as well as a very sharp, analytical, journalistic approach. Mm-hmm. Those things don't go together very often, and it made a big impression on me, and I've always tried to... That's been my direction as well. I mean, I'm not him, but I really like that combination in film.
It's interesting to hear that's what your work is rooted in. Didn't know that about you. I'm curious, in the couple minutes we have left, to talk a little bit about the future of documentary, because the work you're doing, and Sam Green, who we're speaking with here on KCPW, is here at Sundance with The Measure of All Things, a live documentary. But the comments you're making about coming from a journalistic background, and about what documentary means to you and what inspires you, lead me to wonder where you think this form is heading. Because in an era in which there's so many different types of nonfiction content,
yeah,
whether that be online, on television, reality television, documentary films at this festival alone that, you know, run the gamut of the types of documentary styles we've seen, you know, in the history of the form. I know it's not a fair question, but where do you see this going, or what intrigues you about sort of where this form is going?
Well, it's a great question and something I think about a lot, and I think other people do too. I love documentary. There's a lot of documentary filmmakers who make one or two documentaries, and that's their way into fiction films. And I've never been like that. I am only interested in real things in the world. So it interests me and concerns me, the future of documentary. It's exciting now, I think, because up until very recently, documentary was a very rigid form in a way. You could make a television documentary or a theatrical documentary, and that was sort of it. Mm-hmm. And we're at this moment of explosion where they're web-based things, or I'm sort of going in the other direction, which is a kind of performance documentary. There's now, you could say, documentary installations in museums. Mm-hmm. And so the form has sort of opened up in this very exciting way. I mean, that's the positive spin on it. The glass half empty, I mean, there's obviously sort of critiques or ways you can grumble about that, but I focus on the positive.
The Measure of All Things looks at and is a series of, as it's described in the catalog, portraits of people and places, and in ways it's inspired by the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yes.
Why did that subject appeal to you?
That's so, I came across about 3 years ago an old paperback Guinness Book of Records from the 70s, and as a kid, I was enthralled by the Guinness Book of Records, and I opened it up and remembered all the old photos that I just were burned into my consciousness.
The guy with the long nails, or the
the lady with the narrowest waist, the fat twins on motorcycles. Just, and I read it and was actually very moved by the book.
Yeah,
because it's sort of silly, but it's also a very interesting thing about chance and fate. So it sort of came out of that.
How can folks, we're wrapping up this interview, how can folks see this project or some of the other work that you do? You're taking it on the road all the time.
Yeah.
How can they get more information, and where will you be presenting work in the near future?
My website is samgreen.to, so people can check that, and that leads to all the websites for the film. So Measure of All Things, there's a website for that, and we post the tour upcoming dates. It's almost like a rock band.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a lot of the Buckminster Fuller shows, and we'll be doing shows of The Measure of All Things with this great band, Y Music. That's who's doing the score now. And so we'll be all over on the road.
To folks who are listening in from various places, check out samgreen.to. And when he passes through your town or gets close to your town, get in a car and check it out, because he's a really cool guy. And walk up to him at the end and say hello.
Aww.
Sam Green, thank you very much for being on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you so much, Eugene. It's a pleasure.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on KCPW, kcpw.org, filmlink.com, and on iTunes. Talking with my colleague from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, Mr. Matt Bolish.
Hey there.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Excited to have you because not only because this is your first year,
right.
And I find it fun to talk to people about their first Sundance experience, their virgin Sundance experience.
Oh, it's been an experience.
But in particular, I wanted to sit down with you on the Daily Buzz because you've been immersing yourself in New Frontier.
Well done.
An appropriate use of the term immerse because New Frontier is really about immersive media, transmedia. To folks who are listening in and maybe who haven't kind of experienced New Frontier,
mm-hmm.
you have been the last few days. Tell us what it is and tell us what immersive media, transmedia, what these terms mean. And this is you're a programmer of this content back at home at the Film Society, so
right, yeah,
you're
I
an
am,
expert.
I'm very lucky to work with New York Film Festival and Film Society on a program called Convergence, which is all about kind of similar thing, which is immersive storytelling, which is really kind of, if you sum it up, it's storytelling that jumps off the screen and asks you to participate in some way. Because we've seen the kind of old idea of the passive audience sitting in a theater and just kind of taking in a film or television or whatever else is kind of melting away a little bit. And what New Frontier does and what Shari Freilot and her team here have done year over year, done a great job is kind of being the people who are at the forefront of this, mm-hmm. who are challenging the way people interact with their stories.
So give us an example
yeah,
of
sure.
what that means, because on the one hand, people might be thinking like choose your own adventure.
Well, which is not too.
What does it mean to interact with?
Sure, sure.
When something jumps off a screen, what does that mean?
Well, absolutely.
And maybe you can use some examples of.
Yeah,
what's
absolutely.
Happening
here. And some of the you know favorite things that I've seen here that kind of show you a little bit. If you're at Sundance right now, or you're on YouTube and you've seen their trailer, you see this thing of the Egyptian theater.
Yeah, okay.
That's flashing. It looks like it's alive. The walls are just. You know, all the films and all the titles and all these amazing moments of films, you know, 30 years of Sundance history. Well, that was done by a group called Clip Collective. And that is actually, you know, you can go to the Egyptian theater every night and see that stuff projected against it. What that is telling the story of Sundance mm-hmm. in these amazing dynamic images as you walk by. And it uses the actual building as a canvas. That's one kind of way to
So rather than the theater being a place, the Egyptian theater, the iconic theater of Sundance, mm-hmm. being a place you walk into, sit down and turn the lights out and watch a movie, the theater itself becomes
right,
the theater, becomes the screen,
it
I
becomes,
guess.
Exactly.
The front of the theater, the facade becomes the screen.
The facade becomes the screen, exactly. And it tells this amazing, rich story that anyone can get. You don't have to have, you can be a newbie like me and walk down the street and like, oh my gosh, this is the history of this whole festival right here, right there.
And you don't even need a ticket.
You don't even need a ticket to see it. And that's actually the really cool thing about New Frontier in general is that this is open to the public. I mean, it's open at noon every day and you can go in and experience because the thing about it is, and this is going to sound silly as someone who's being interviewed about transmedia or immersive storytelling, the best way to learn about it mm-hmm. is to actually grab it and play with it and see it. There's mm-hmm. a very big kind of play and engage kind of mentality in this kind of work. Mm-hmm. So you can head down to Gateway Center and check it out and really kind of engage with some of this stuff. Again, like a good example.
I love that you're looking at your old school notebook.
I am looking. I'm talking in out of an analog.
You've written notes on a page.
On
a
page
pen.
With a pen. Yeah, with not. It wasn't even a digital pen or anything. It's
ink.
Ink with real ink. There's this great interactive documentary called okay. Clouds that you can check out over there. And actually, there's two ways you can check it out. One way is you sit down and there's a big, vast screen. And what it is it's this very engaging series of interviews with artists, programmers, creatives, kind of a next generation creative community mm-hmm. about everything from art to how what they do, how they make art is different and just kind of you know, breaking a mold, if you will. And the way this works is you sit down in front of the screen and it uses an Xbox Kinect. And you actually can manipulate the images that you're seeing. You can reach your hands out in front of you mm-hmm. and move the images around on a screen. You can decide, oh, you know what? I'm sick of hearing from this guy. I want to go listen to that other guy. So there's a button that you just basically punch your hand through. Mm-hmm. And you are just immediately, I mean, in that 1 second, you're engaged, mm-hmm. and you are actually steering the story. I mean, they've done a great job of providing you all of this content for you to kind of explore mm-hmm. and to dig into. But how you get about it and how you see it and what you focus on is entirely up to you.
So it's like a roadmap with a whole bunch of different forks in the road.
Yeah.
All of them get you to the same destination, but the path you take might be different.
And in fact, one of the things that's part of the display are these other screens that show the web mm-hmm. that connects all of these different, you know, interviews and pieces of content. So you can see, oh, I'm talking to so-and-so now, or I'm hearing from so-and-so now, and they're a programmer that lives in New York, and this is what they do, and mm-hmm. then they're talking about what they do. And then it's, I have to say, it's one of the most sleek kind of you know, beautiful examples of kind of interactive documentaries. And in this field, in transmedia, immersive storytelling, whatever you want to call it, there's really, documentarians have really latched onto this and done some really amazing, amazing stuff. To that, one of the neat things at New Frontier this year is a whole section about the, or brought to you by the Oculus Rift, which this next generation VR headset, fully immersive, you know, sound, virtual reality, pardon me. And I mean, it sounds like it's exactly as cool as it sounds, where you put these giant goggles on and suddenly you're in a Beck concert. And this amazing concert video or concert film that Chris Milk and Beck put together, that you are there. And I mean, if you look to the left, you look to the right, you look up, you look down, you see all these people around you and you hear it in beautiful, you know, 360 audio. And that changes depending on where you're looking and what you're engaging with. I mean, this could really change the way that we you know, engage with our stories, which is what's so exciting about it. And again, it's one thing to hear me talk about it, but the best possible thing you can do is go out and play with it yourself.
Let me ask you a question. Let me take a step back.
Yeah,
the three
sure.
minutes we have left. You're fully engaged in this world of immersive storytelling year-round. You're mm-hmm. looking for projects. You're traveling to festivals to find and curate work to bring to the New York Film Festival in the fall. But take a step back and tell me what interests you in this field? Why is it so interesting to you specifically? What sort of instigates you? What sort of keeps you engaged in this field? Why is it so interesting?
Well, when I was a kid, I mean, you brought up Choose Your Own Adventures books. And I was one of those kids that had like all of them. And one of my greatest failures as an adult is losing them. Like, I don't have them anymore. That's another story. But that and gameplay. And I mean, we live in a world where we now have the ability through our tablets and our phones and our computers and, you know, even new kind of crazy technologies that, you know, you just walk into a room and it knows who you are to tell stories and experience stories in a way that's completely visceral. Mm. And actually, very much, you know, it kind of harkens back to campfire days when someone would tell a story and, mm-hmm. you know, there would be the guy with the hook and the claw and someone grabs you from behind. That stuff that we can, I mean, without grabbing people, of course, we're not advocating that. That's what excites me about this, is that, you know, creative, intelligent people are actually telling a story in 360 degrees. And we're no longer talking about a linear kind of, you know, beginning, middle, end anymore. It's a dialogue between creators and audience members and then the artists that are on screen, on stage, whatever. And that's what's so exciting to me. It's kind of the Wild West. And it lacks in definition, it makes up for in some just crazy, amazing things that, you know, it's just amazing to see what people come up with. I guess that's what keeps me going.
You talk about the creator grabbing the audience and makes me think of a project back in New York, Sleep No More.
Oh, absolutely.
That actually happens.
Yes, they actually
do grab you.
they don't. Yeah, it's so funny to hear people talk about Sleep No More, but you're absolutely right, because it sounds like it's a haunted house, and it's really a little Shakespeare, a little haunted house, a little Sam Spade. But that's exactly it.
The audience interacts with the actors who are moving among you,
right,
in this space.
Yeah, you buy a ticket.
But you're part of a theater project.
It's a fully. I mean, there's a giant cast and it's a giant hotel. You walk in, you put a mask on, and you're there for hours if you'd like. Anyhow.
Our guest on The Daily Buzz here on KCPW has been Matt Bolish, my colleague from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, programmer of our Convergence program, which shares a lot in common with the New Frontier program here at the Sundance Film Festival. In the 20 seconds we have left, maybe name off just a couple of the titles of a couple of projects that people should check out at New Frontier.
Sure, absolutely. I already mentioned Clouds. There's Sound and Vision, which is that Beck documentary, or not documentary, but concert film. Street, which is by James Nares.
Love that piece.
It's fantastic. It was at the Metropolitan Museum. It's something you should see. It's out in front, so you can see it every night.
Thank you very much, Matt Bolish.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes.
And we're wrapping up this Wednesday edition of The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. I want to thank our sponsors, including our host venue, Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main, Soyombo, Sabra, Skullcandy, and Cloud Electronics, as well as our in-kind supporters, All Good Provisions, Super Good Bars, and People Water. On the next edition of The Daily Buzz, Stuart Murdoch from Bell and Sebastian will be here. He has a new movie called God Help the Girl. We'll also talk with the filmmakers behind a number of Sundance films, Appropriate Behavior, The Case Against 8, Copenhagen, which is playing over at Slamdance, Song 1 from Sundance, as well as Kara Mertes from the Ford Foundation. That's on the next edition of The Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org, filmlink.com, and as a podcast on iTunes. Until then, we'll be back tomorrow.